Imagine like you're in a classroom and a child suddenly throws a chair just because someone slammed a door down the hall. Your first instinct is probably, to discipline them.
Oh, absolutely. It's just human nature to react that way.
Right. But what if that child isn't being disobedient at all? Welcome to this custom deep dive. Today we're decoding chapter 6 of the Tip for Kids guidelines to figure out how you can navigate and de-escalate a child's psychological crisis using trauma-informed practices.
Yeah, because those sudden moments of panic or aggression
Yeah.
or even just complete withdrawal, they might actually be a trauma response.
Triggered by something tiny, right? Like a loud noise or a weird smell or even an unexpected substitute teacher.
Exactly. And these reactions are, well, they're constantly mislabeled as stubbornness,
Yeah.
but a traumatized child is living in this constant state of hypervigilance.
They're just always scanning for threats.
Right. Always. So before you try to stop the behavior, you really have to understand the biological reality behind it.
Which is that during a crisis, their brain is just so overwhelmed by stress that it simply cannot process complex language. It's like a faulty smoke detector.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
The brain's logic center gets completely shut off by the amygdala. So the alarm is so loud that the child literally cannot hear your instructions over their own internal sirens.
Yeah.
So how are you supposed to react when that alarm is blaring?
Well, the absolute worst thing you can do in that moment is demand explanations. Like, do not demand cooperation.
Because they literally can't give it to you.
Exactly. The goal is stabilization. You just must stay calm and acknowledge their feelings without judgment. Saying something simple like, I see you're upset, that validates the emotion without forcing them to rationalize it.
And then you offer micro choices, right, to restore their sense of control, like asking, would you like water or juice?
Or do you want to sit on the chair or the floor?
Keeping it to really short, clear instructions like sit here instead of a big, long lecture.
Right. And the sources list out a toolkit for grounding the child, too. Things like asking them to name objects in the room or handing them a smooth stone to hold.
Or even using puppets and drumming to release physical stress. But I mean, I'm trying to visualize this in a chaotic
It
situation.
can be messy, yeah.
Like, if a child is actively panicking, telling them to focus on a stone or telling them to take a deep breath usually backfires completely.
Oh,
So,
totally.
how do you actually get a kid in crisis to do a breathing exercise?
Well, it will backfire if you try to teach it during the crisis. The trick the guidelines emphasize is that you have to make these exercises playful and normalize them long before an emergency ever
Oh,
happens.
so you practice them daily in short, fun sessions.
Exactly.
That makes sense. So that's why the text suggests having them pretend to be a sleeping dragon or placing a stuffed toy on their belly to watch it rise and fall.
Yeah, because it teaches diaphragmatic breathing. And that engages the parasympathetic nervous system, which is essentially hitting the body's biological brake pedal to stop the adrenaline rush.
It physically forces the body to relax.
It does. But the child's brain will only let that happen if the action is already a familiar, safe habit.
Okay, so say the breathing worked, right? The child's heart rate is down, the room is quiet again. But the sources point out a trap here.
Right, just because the crying stopped doesn't mean the intervention is over.
The immediate aftermath is critical,
It
yeah.
really is. You need to return to normal routines as quickly as possible because predictability provides security for them.
And then later, when everyone is fully calm, you gently debrief.
Right, asking things like, what helped you calm down? Which reinforces their coping attempts and really builds future resilience.
But I'm looking at the patience required to maintain this calm, structured presence day in and day out. I mean, it seems like it would drain a caregiver completely. How do adults sustain this without burning out?
Honestly, they often don't. And that's why the guidelines highlight the biological toll on the adult.
Because you're constantly regulating a child's spiked nervous system.
Right. You are absorbing a massive amount of that emotional weight. And this leads to secondary trauma, where the caregiver's own brain starts mirroring the symptoms of trauma.
Like exhaustion, hypervigilance, and emotional numbing. You literally catch the stress.
You really do. That's why the rule is absolute.
Yeah.
Adults must practice self-care and actively share their feelings with peers after a crisis.
Because you can't be a steady anchor if your own ship is sinking.
Perfectly said.
Ultimately, a calm, regulated adult presence is the single most powerful tool for a child's emotional regulation. You really have to be the grounded force in the room.
You do. It's essential.
But reading through all of this leaves you with something to really ponder. I mean, if a minor sensory detail, like a sudden loud noise or a change in routine, can trigger a massive trauma spiral, how could we completely redesign our everyday environment?
That is the big question.
Right. From our classrooms to our community centers. What if we built them to be passively trauma-informed by default?
Oh, wow.
Imagine designing a world where those faulty smoke detectors never even get a chance to go off.